gives me the session after lunch. And I made the mistake of asking the ladies to overfeed us. So I'm going to be working very hard this afternoon. If you hear me shouting, it's just to keep you awake. I love you so much to shout at you, so you can relax. We've had quite an excellent excellent presentations, rather, from the two earlier speakers, and the discussions were very good. So I'm going to touch on a few things that we have learned along in the area of African diaspora and some of the things that they've experienced here in the UK. My name is Anderson. We came to England with my wife 14 years ago with a 4-month-old baby. We were the guinea pigs in my denomination to be sent out as missionaries to Britain. And then 15 years later, we have reflected, we have acted, we have thought, and we still want to think some more and act more. So at some point I said to Israel and Harvey, how about bringing over this conference to the north so that we can learn together, but also to meet different ones. And this gathering is amazing that we can actually come together and talk about mission. So let's get a picture of Africa, African diaspora mission here. I was going to define missiology and all that, but I think Dr. Samuel has done a good job for us. So I'm going to assume that's covered and go into something different. So the history of Christianity in the 21st century will be incomplete without the inclusion of a chapter on the exponential growth of the African church. African Christianity has exploded. In fact, Andrew Walls says that if you want to know something about Christianity, you must know something about Africa. So, although Christian mission predates the 17th century, it was the Windrush migration of the African Caribbean people after the Second World War that pioneered a way for waves of African reverse missionaries to come into the United Kingdom. So I come up with three major waves of African missionaries coming into the United Kingdom. The first wave of migration was in the between 70s and mid 1980s. These were political migrants predominantly from West Africa, namely Nigeria. We're not yet there, my media guy. It's just... these are my notes, yeah. So, Nigerians came in as a first group. And I was thinking about the other day saying, Nigerians have been in England for more than 50 years. Amazing. That's a generation. So, reflection should happen a lot more at 50. That's amazing. So that was the first group, and an example of a church, what Dad was planted about that time is the Deeper Christian Life Ministry. From Lagos, that was planted in the UK in 1983. The second wave of African migrants was in the period between 1980 and mid-1990s. I think this was the biggest wave of student migrants, mainly coming from across the continent of Africa, but a majority of these were emanating from West Africa. This is where we talk about Ghana and Nigeria. For example, Church of Pentecost was planted in the UK in 1985 as a missionary movement that was trying to reach out to their people here in the UK. According to Caleb Nyani, the church was a continuation and a branch of the mother church in Ghana to serve the Ghanaians in the UK. The final wave of African migrants occurred in the period between mid-1990s and 2010. Or story about, this was the largest inflow of Christians from mainly East and Southern Africa. An example is Zimbabwe. Because of political problems in Zimbabwe, a lot of people left. But the Zimbabwean migrants, even though they were political, there was a different strand to that. They were what we call economic migrants. These were professionals, doctors, nurses, that voted with their feet. And just when the moment the political situation changed, they simply jumped on a plane and found themselves in the UK. So that was a big migrant move for Zimbabwe in particular. The Zambians as well. There was a migration of the Zambians. For example, Ramson Mumba from Zambia planted his church in 1998 in Bradford, and it exploded in growth. So just to give you a contextual overview of African Christianity in the diaspora, African missionaries in the diaspora have to grapple with a lot of things, and one of them is managing ties with the motherland, leaving the village behind, ministering to a postmodern society, which is significantly different from the global south. There are also issues of abortion, issues of gay rights, issues of euthanasia, care for the aged, drug and substance abuse, and child discipline. An African missionary has to learn to deal with these things as they come. This is the reality of what African Christianity in the diaspora is caught up in. But there's also the geopolitical and spiritual landscape of Europe in general and Britain in particular that has changed significantly over the last generation. And it's been characterized by the following. The first is the unprecedented levels of secularization and rationalization in the church. The second point is just to do with the steady rise of nationalism leading to the tightening of borders and immigration controls in Western Europe. And the third one is the rise of Islam in Europe and in UK in particular as a result of push factors in the Middle East. There are countries that are given special treatment because of the push factors, for example, Syria or Syrians. And the last point has to do with the continuous decline in church attendance in Europe. I think that this is just a slice of what the spiritual landscape is like in the United Kingdom. It's not even current, but it gives you an idea of what is happening. 6% drop between 2010 and 2015, envisaged that there might be a 6% drop in the number of Christians. And you can see from the breakdown that the mainline churches are having the biggest hit in terms of drop in attendance. They say that, statistics say that on average, Methodist church is closing one church a week. They are the fastest declining church at the moment in the United Kingdom. So in the midst of such formidable developments in Europe, there is an emerging missiological phenomena that is coming in at the right time. That is things that we still don't know what to call them. Some call them immigrant churches. Some call them diaspora churches. Some call them homogeneous churches. Some call them multi-ethnic churches. Some call them Zimbabwean churches, Ghanaian churches, Zimbabwean or Nigerian churches. We still, theologically, we still haven't agreed on what to call them. And I suppose these deliberations are helping us think about such things. We have a church called the Redeemed Christian Church of God. With all this that you're seeing here, the Redeemed Church of God came up with a target of planting 100 new churches in 2017 alone. Between 2005 and 2010, they planted 190 new churches in the UK. And RCC now is the fastest growing church in England after they've overtaken Elim Church. And they are in two-thirds of the cities in the United Kingdom. So from a missiological point of view, post-Christendom Britain has become a foreign mission field in the global north for mission to happen in reverse. If Britain is now a foreign mission field, and the only churches making missional progress in terms of church planting are diaspora churches, we then need to take a closer look at these emerging missionaries and analyze their philosophy of ministry for contextual relevance and test their saltiness. So before we delve into that, I want us to look at the entry points of how do African diaspora churches start in Britain. Hugh Osgood identified 5 approaches used by African missionaries in Britain to plant churches. Namely, he came up with the first one is constraint to plant. I think we've got them coming up on the screen. Constraint to plant. He identified a constraint to plant as the first one. And in this one, these are students who came from Africa. And then they realized that, my goodness, we cannot fit in the traditional churches. So they then started fellowships on their own to mainly look after their kind. And then churches started. So they felt constrained to start something to meet the spiritual needs of their people. So everything was done according to what they knew from the mother church in Africa in terms of language, in terms of liturgy, in terms of cultural mannerisms. This was for the first generation. The second one is sent to plant. These are African churches responding to diasporic missional opportunities in Britain. So a church will send people to the UK, commissioned to shepherd people from their church. For example, the Roman Catholic Church of Zimbabwe sent a priest, a senior leader in their denomination, to come and look after, I call it the maintenance ministry, to look after their people. Make sure they don't wander off, as it were. Number 3 is transferred to plant. Transferred to plant is a refinement of the limitations of the sent to plant model. Control is still coming from denominational headquarters somewhere in Lagos, Harare, Nairobi, Johannesburg, or Accra. This category refers to reverse missionaries initially sent to plant, but they then break away and stand on their own, as it were. And this breakaway syndrome is particularly common in African charismatic Pentecostal churches in the diaspora due to differences in perception of how the church ought to function in a new contextual setting. Trained to plant is the 4th one. This trained to plant one is where a few African missionaries enrolled for theological training in Britain. This is a group where those that go for theological training in Britain, when they come out of there, they have this sense to plant churches. And when they plant churches, because of their theological training, they think differently about missions. So therefore, theological training is very, very important when it comes to reverse missionaries with cross-cultural competence issues involved. The last one is called to plant. I think this is the most entrepreneurial of the lot, because it has to do with what we call tent makers. This group of people is made up of African pastors that are not trained for ministry at all. They work during the day and try to do church in the evenings and weekends. Their training comes mainly from TV, CDs, conference after conference, but they have a passion to do something for the kingdom of God. The good news about that is that it cuts the budget. The church is not burdened with financial constraints, as it were. And usually they are free of denominational control. So these are the 5 ways in which most African diaspora churches have come to exist in the UK. Osgood describes, his description is that Africans have a strong church planting mindset. He uses that expression. And a good example of that is to take a bus ride on Old Kent Road in South London, in the South York Borough, where the diversity of African Christianity, there are over 25 black-led churches in a space of less than 1.5 miles. That is where you experience the evidence of the proclamation of the globalization of Christianity in the UK. While it is true that African Christianity is experiencing explosive growth in the diaspora, it is imperative that we examine the reasons behind this growth and maybe even see what is wrong, what is making them grow, or what is making them grow in one dimension. For some of them, they're growing in one dimension. Israel here, the editor of the African Voices, wrote that studying mission is necessary for mission practice because it helps to improve and measure our performance of God's mission. One of my professors used to say that missions is what you do during the day, missiology is what you do in the evening when you go to think about what you've been doing all day. And if you don't reflect on what you've been doing all day, you'll keep doing the same thing every day and not realizing that the game has changed. So missiology is very, very important to look at. And this is what we're doing today. One of the outcomes of research and debate on the theology of diasporic mission is an in-depth biblical exegesis of scriptures on church planting and an anthropological analysis of how people groups and their cultures interact with the scriptures. While churches are growing, we still have to go to the scriptures and examine and exegete whether it ties in with the scriptures. I want us to look in particular at something very important for African churches in the diaspora, and it's the homogeneous unit principle, HUP. The narrative of the growth of African Christianity can be better understood by analyzing the church planting patterns and underlying variable characteristics of these churches. African churches are known as cultural reservoirs for Africans to gather around. I think they do more than spiritual fellowship. There's a sense of coming to contact with people that are familiar to your culture, to your songs, to your manners, and all that kind of thing. So that they are regarded as cultural reservoirs in a way because they attract people, not necessarily Christians, but they are kind of the social life is entangled with African churches. One of the key characteristics of these churches is the HUP, homogeneous unit principle, that was introduced by Donald McGovern. Donald McGovern was an American who was a missionary in India. And from his experience in India, he came up with this theory that people are best reached when they're reached by a person like them who attracts them using things that they are familiar with. That was his underpinning kind of thinking. But Mark Gavran really was focusing on church growth. So he was concerned that if the church is to grow, then we need to get to people by using people that are like them. That was his experience from India. So HUP will have common characteristics such as geography, ethnicity, language, social or educational status, and all those things. He felt that if this is in place, the church will grow. But Mark Gravan, helped by Peter Wagner, formulated a sociologically embedded evangelistic strategy. It was very sociological in its approach. And it's true that people respond to those that are like them. However, that's not all there is about missiology. And somehow, HUP fits perfect with homogeneous churches. They love it. I don't know whether you see, there's a kind of an awkward relationship. When I came to the UK, when we came with my wife to plant a church, I felt we were thrust into missiology because of our frustration with lack of church growth. Our church wasn't growing. 5 years, nothing was happening that was worth talking about. And yet across the road, some churches from Zimbabwe were exploding. That was missions. Until I started asking questions, why is your church growing and ours is not growing? And it comes to HUP. They were intentional in reaching to Zimbabweans. We were intentional in avoiding reaching Zimbabweans. But then at some point when the migration policy changed against Zimbabwe, the growth plateaued because there was no longer a feeding conveyor belt of migrants from Zimbabwe to get into the homogeneous churches. That's where HUP has got problems when you think of it in terms of missiology, but not missions. The exegetical demands of New Testament theology on missions are not satisfied by church growth anchored on a particular target population group. The missiological implication of focusing on church growth in numeric terms without exploring other equally important fundamental realities is selective theology. What are some of the significant factors in African diaspora churches? One of the most significant factors I found out from research with African churches and Zimbabwean churches in particular has to do with what I call external authority church structures. Came up with this quadrant to simply analyze how it works out in terms of a church becoming a homogeneous unit church or a multi-ethnic church. There are factors that influence that based on this quadrant. For example, quadrant one is identified as where there's a dominant external authority that is affecting this diaspora church from reaching out to people that are not from Zimbabwe, for example. That's quadrant one. There's dominant external authority. Because there's dominant external authority, it means that they're receiving policies and vision that is contextually not relevant to Britain. So a missional strategy that is working in Nairobi, for example, in Kabera is a slum, might not do any wonders here in Chapel Town, Sheffield. Quadrant two is where a church is transitioning from being a homogeneous church to wanting to be a multi-ethnic church. So it's a church in transition. But then, again, you realize that external authority gets less as the church is trying to transition to becoming multi-ethnic. Quadrant four is identified with churches that are independent of external authority. These are usually churches that have no control at all from Africa. They're headquartered here, and everything is done from here. Internal authority structure is stronger than the external control structure. Quadrant four is a strange one because this is where a multi-ethnic church coexists with external authority structure. For example, these are churches that are planted here in the UK that then plant in Africa, and the African church sees their influence as external authority. So what then should we do given the roadblocks that most homogeneous churches face when they're trying to reach out to the host population and it seems fruitless? Well, we have to go to the Bible, not to sociology, to find the answer. And the answer is in Acts 11, the Antioch church. Migrants were running away from the persecution that had broke out in Jerusalem. They found themselves in Antioch. they started reaching to Jews first, and then they moved on to Gentiles. There was an explosion. A church was put together. Barnabas came over, sent by Jerusalem Church, and the church grew. They were a discipling church. Paul joined them to teach. And before we knew it, there was a switch, with Jerusalem being the first church, as it were, strong as it was, but Antioch became the world missionary center that was sending out missionaries who went out to plant multi-ethnic churches. So there's something significant about the Acts 11 church model that I want to look at before I close. So I came up with these seven kind of elements that we can glean from the Antioch church and that we can apply. Here in Sheffield Community Church, for example, when we discovered this, we obviously we prayed. And because of missiology, we started reflecting what we were doing and how we can apply this in such a way that it fits our context here in Sheffield. And then there was that switch from church, which was once looking homogeneous, to now becoming more and more multi-ethnic because of this model. So let's look at mission, the first one. The core elements of developing a multi-ethnic church starts with the mission of the church, the mission charter. For most homogeneous churches, the vision is coming from Lagos. For example, you can have a vision that says, we want to plant a church that is within 5 minutes walk from each home. Now, in Europe, that wouldn't translate to 5 minutes. You're talking about 15 minutes drive. People are prepared to drive for 15 minutes to get to a church. But if the mission charter is coming from Harare, Harare will insist that you do what we told you, or what we're telling you. Whereas a mission charter really should be shaped by the context and what the Spirit of the Lord is saying for that particular place. So an expansive mission statement kind of opens up the church to all sorts of people walking in. And this is not just a statement nailed on a wall, but I'm talking about the mission statement affecting the philosophy of the church, the worship style, the liturgy, and the leadership. All this should be affected by the mission statement. A majority of African churches are HU branches transplanting the ministry philosophy of the homeland church. They are an extension of what's happening somewhere in Africa. The pioneers of Antioch Church had to start thinking about how they minister in Antioch. You'll notice that they dropped the title Messiah and started talking about Kyrios, Jesus Christ. And Kyrios is something very similar to what they call Caesar. But the Greeks understood that. When you're saying Messiah to the Greeks, that was too Jewish for them. There was contextualization. So one of the key strategies for transforming African homogeneous churches to become multi-ethnic churches is to redefine the mission charter to express the dynamic diversity they now live in. Number two is population opportunity. This term came from an American sociologist called Emerson, and there were two, Emerson and Kim. Population opportunity simply means that there is an existence of an ethnic group of people in an area where your church might be based. 5 minutes, okay. So whenever you are in a place where there are people not like you, it means that the people not like you have an opportunity to become a part of your church. So they called it the population opportunity. But again, that makes sense for homogeneous churches. For example, if you're in a place where there are only Zimbabweans, you cannot have a multi-ethnic church. But that's discounted if you're in Britain. Because Britain is a pluralistic society, isn't it? So that means that the population opportunity for diaspora churches is unbelievable. So the missiological implication of radical demographic changes in Europe is beckoning us to plant multi-ethnic churches. Then there's disciple-making factor. The Antioch church was discipled. The Antioch church was well discipled in the faith. And the fact that Paul was brought in, a theologian, to be a part of the building of people of God tells you how serious discipleship is for a multi-ethnic church, because in discipleship, questions can be asked and lots of things can be discussed and dealt with in a non-threatening environment. So discipleship is very, very key for churches that are wanting to become multi-ethnic. Core cultural issues can also be discussed. Communication styles can be touched on. It's a holistic curriculum that can be covered through the platform of discipleship. Then there's a pragmatic authority structure. A pragmatic authority structure is the alternative to external authority structure. So instead of having external authority structure coming from Zimbabwe, or in our case, for example, Sheffield Community Church is part of what is called Faith Ministries International. And one of the things that we did when we came over to the UK was to start discussing, who do I report to? That was a very important question. And I was told straight away by our church leader that I don't report to Harare. I said, thank God. Thank God. What we had to do was to form a new international council made up of senior ministers that have been exposed to mission outside of the Zimbabwean context. Then it is this international council that we are accountable to, not to Harare. That is called an example of a pragmatic authority structure. So while we compare notes with Harare, Harare does not send a memo saying this is what you should do. If anything, we can challenge it using our context. So that's a pragmatic authority structure. And then there is social engagement. I think my time is gone. Social engagement, a channel for mission and integration. When you talk about social engagement, I think it is John Stott who contends that charitable acts of the Antioch Church were a way of building solidarity with the Jerusalem Church. And he puts high value in that type of solidarity. When a church responds to social needs in the community, it changes relationships in a dynamic way. Because through it builds social capital for the church and challenges social constructs like racial stereotyping. By being close, proximity to the people you're trying to reach to makes a difference to how they think about church. So social engagement for me has to do with breaking boundaries in a way that is meeting the needs of those you're trying to help, but also giving you access to a population that you will not ordinarily reach out to. Number six is ethnically mixed apostolic leadership team. Acts 13 gives us a breakdown of the diversity of the leadership team. It's amazing that Luke takes time to actually name the leadership team of the Antioch church. The Jerusalem church is not named. We assume it's the apostles or the disciples that were in charge. But by the time he hit Acts 15, James is in charge. But this one, Luke takes time to tell us the names and where they come from. And no wonder the Antioch church was so effective and influential, because the leadership reflected the city in which they ministered in. Number seven is mobilization of the diaspora church for global impact. This has to do with the African church understanding the responsibility that is upon the church for global impact. It's not only Britain that has to be touched with the gospel, but it's the globe. And so the African church has to prepare itself for that. And then finally, I think that was the last one, number seven, mobilizing for impact. So what are the implications for this? And then I'll sit down. I think my boss is getting uncomfortable. I've taken much of your time. There are implications to this. The African church needs to move from one-dimensional approach to mission to a multi-dimensional approach to mission. And there's a risk to that, but it's worth it for the sake of the kingdom. Number two, reverse missionaries need to understand that it's a privilege and a responsibility to be involved in God's mission for the world. And number three, Africa can do a lot more in preparing theologically grounded and culturally competent reverse missionaries for the Western world. Africa needs to take responsibility. So, this is how our journey has been with the African church. These are just thoughts. There's a lot more we can do and we can think about. But I hope this will keep you thinking as you go forward. Thank you. Thank you.